Well, hello and welcome to series two of Breaking the Taboo, where we speak about birth trauma. And for the first episode in this series, we have a special bonus episode where, in fact, I won't be your host, but I'll be handing over to journalist and friend Belle Donati. And Belle will be speaking to me about my book, Breaking the Taboo, which was just published in May. So do pick up a copy and I hope you enjoy the episode where Belle will be putting me in the hot seat for once and talking to me about my memoir and my campaign to improve maternity care.
Hello and welcome to this bonus episode of Breaking the Taboo. Now, if you're a regular listener, you'll probably already be thinking, who's this? It's not Theo. Let me introduce myself. I'm Belle Donati. I'm a podcaster, a journalist and a news anchor. I'm a mum to two young children. And crucially today, I have known your regular host, Theo, since we were crikey. How old?
Gosh, I think maybe 10 or 11. So definitely when we were sort of going to school, I think.
Exactly. School age. And we have been through a lot since then. We've been travelling around the world together. We've had countless relationships and breakups and, you know, love chats, sex chats, all the rest of it. I would say the two of us have always been very open with each other. But that was quite tested over what you went through with your birth trauma. That's been put to the test, not only with me, but with a lot of your friends, I think, of how easy it was to talk to us.
And it's so interesting you say that, because I think I found it easier to talk to people I didn't know. So not my oldest, closest friends or immediate family, which is surprising to me too.
So today you're going to have to think of me as the journalist rather than your friend, although hopefully we could do a little bit of the two at the same time. The reason that I'm the one interviewing you today is because this episode is all about you. It's about your experience. Over the course of the series, listeners have heard you talk to campaigners, to families, to medical professionals about birth trauma. But of course, it's your personal story that led you here. And so that's what we're going to focus on today. And of course, we can't have you talking on your own about you and interviewing yourself. So very kindly, you've asked me to come and do that. And I'm delighted to be able to talk to you, my dear friend, today. I think as your friend, well, one thing I'd like to say is, I think when we, several of your friends, when we first understood what was going on with you and we first heard very matter-of-factly what had happened, I don't think any of us really understood the profound effect that it had had on you, both mentally and physically. I know I'm not alone in that because I have spoken to some of our other friends. And I wonder for you, when you first became aware that what you went through wasn't perhaps just a bit of an unlucky birth, but actually something a bit more than that, and possibly something that could have been avoided.
So I think that's such a good place to start, because if I look back to having my daughter, who's my first baby, my only child, I don't think I really knew that much, to be honest, to start on what could go wrong. I think my only real understanding of complications were the C-section. And obviously, I'd heard that talked about in antenatal classes and friends who'd had obviously this major abdominal surgery. But I don't think I really knew about anything else that could go wrong. I certainly didn't know about birth injuries, had very little understanding sort of about PTSD affecting mums. And I think the kind of moment when I realised that maybe what had happened to me was not what had happened to some of my friends was when I was actually looking through a box several weeks later where I just stuffed loads of leaflets from the hospital. And I remember coming across this leaflet, which was about perineal trauma on third degree tears. And I remember thinking, like, what is that? And obviously I immediately went on Google and started researching about it and then uncovered this whole can of worms of like, oh my God, is that what's happened to me? Because to be honest, no one had really sat down and explained to me what had happened during during childbirth. And I think I only really started to understand it actually much later on after the delivery.
So that's extraordinary. So because you suffered a third degree tear on the operating table. We'll get to that part. But what you're saying is that they'd given you some leaflets at the hospital, mm-hmm. but no one had actually sat down whilst you were in a proper state of mind to do so and said to you, you've had a third degree tear, you've been sewn up here and there and everywhere, and this is what's going to happen next. No one had actually had that conversation with you.
No, it, actually looking back, it's kind of extraordinary. I think there's such a focus on looking after my daughter, who, by the way, was absolutely fine. I think she was completely oblivious to what had happened to mum. But yes, that was really the case, is that I was given some leaflets and pretty much discharged and sent home, having had, you know, a multiple night stay in hospital. And I was really not in a good way physically or mentally to be going home. And I basically couldn't look after my daughter.
Well, and of course, what's crazy about that is that you go home, and if you need to go into hospital or see a doctor after that, you can't even explain to a medical professional what's happened to you to then ask for the right help. So, yeah, I mean, that is quite baffling to think of. I can't think of many situations where a patient would leave a hospital after major surgery and not have had a sort of post-surgery report, conversation with the surgeon and sort of understand what went on.
Yeah, and even when I went to my GP, they didn't have a copy of my notes, and it's only like a few miles between where I was having my local surgery in Staffordshire and my hospital in Staffordshire. And because they're different hospital trusts and different computer systems, they didn't have a copy. So whereas my daughter, I'd obviously bring her red book to all her appointments and you knew about her health, there was no equivalent for me. So they literally didn't even know, even though I was a patient in the same county.
We've sort of started, which is nice, at the beginning, and I do kind of want to unpick your journey from that early stage. So we've dealt with that kind of what you knew before you went into labour. You talked about, you know, antenatal classes. Do you think that antenatal classes could do a little more to prepare women for what could go wrong without scaring mums? Because I think, you know, pregnant women are very vulnerable. And I think I can understand that antenatal practitioners might not want to frighten unnecessarily some mothers going into labour. But what can be done in that?
So I did take quite a lot of time before my daughter arrived to sort of research. You know, I'm one of those people that likes to prep. I went and bought all the books.
No,
I listened to podcasts.
Theo,
I remember ringing
you surprised me
and saying, like, you know, what should I pack in my hospital bag, and having lists. And I like to be,
I remember giving
organized.
You some of your hospital
yes,
bag.
No, you
yeah.
did. It was very, very helpful. But I think when I went to my antenatal classes, I joined NCT mainly because I wanted to meet other mums locally. And it's so useful to have, you know, someone you can WhatsApp at 3 a.m. who's having a similar problem to you and will probably reply with an answer. But I also thought I'd get really practical advice. And to be honest, I think everything I was told was so focused on looking after the baby that there wasn't really much talked about the mum and our physical health at all. So I think I had really the wrong expectations, that I just basically assumed that everything would be about looking after the baby. All the questions I were asking, the things like how to change a nappy, you know, how to wear a baby sling, you know, what do you do when you go to the supermarket and you're trying to carry a shopping trolley and you're also trying to carry your daughter at the same time. But I didn't really ask enough about the physical complications that you could have.
Yeah, and I also did NCT with my first child and have an incredible group of mum friends still now, 5 years later from that. One thing I felt was that you did your birth plan, you sort of felt, you know, you've thought your way through your preferences. And in my mind, I always thought, and then I also have to be prepared, as everyone says, to rip up the birth plan and go with whatever happens, because you never know what's going to happen on the day. However, what was missing, I think, from that was a sense that actually you might be called on to make decisions in the midst of a very difficult labour. And like yours, mine was very long, sort of 70 hours or something. And in the end, pretty uncomplicated, but long. Mm-hmm. And I was exhausted. And without an epidural, I don't know how I'd have got through it. I didn't prepare myself for actually having to try and make decisions that definitely I should have been making before I was in that state, because I wasn't in a fit state to make decisions. I think you think, I'm going to go into that labour and I will just then, if things start to go wrong, I'll just hand over all responsibility to the medical professionals and I don't need to worry, they'll just do their job. Do you think, I mean, well, given what you've been through, do you think that is an adequate way to go into labour?
Absolutely not. And that was exactly the case with me. I mean, the first example that jumps to mind was my daughter was late. So my due date was on my birthday, and 2 weeks after she was meant to arrive, she still hadn't. And I was told that I'd be induced. And to be honest, I knew nothing about induction of labour. It was something that had barely been mentioned in any of the stuff that I'd been researching. And it was an incredibly traumatic experience, because I was basically put into a bay with several other women at different stages of labour to me. So I could hear them groaning with contractions. And, you know, you've just arrived. You know that the risks of something going wrong, now you're so many days past your due date, have obviously gone up considerably. And it was really quite frightening to arrive and not to have any understanding and very little expectations of what was happening. And then to go through this grueling process for nearly 40 hours, where I was basically trying to force my body into going into labour because she hadn't gone in spontaneously and naturally. And I had some really difficult experiences. I mean, For me, vaginal examinations were incredibly triggering. I was taken in, I think, the first time to a room which felt more like a prison than it did a hospital. They refused to let my husband come with me. And for anyone who's had
Do you know why?
This is back to your point about rights. Like, I didn't even know that I could ask for him to come. I just assumed that when I was taken off that that was the situation. And then it was so incredibly painful and invasive doing
what
the
procedure. What were they doing for those? Was it a sweep or what kind of a medical?
No, so I had two different things. So, yeah, sweeps, again, something no one had mentioned before. So I ended up having several what are called membrane sweeps. And that, again, was because I was overdue. Go to see your midwife and they try to basically stimulate your cervix into going into labour naturally. And just incredibly painful.
The way they do that, for the listener, in case we've got some people who haven't had that happen to them, is they, you know, the nurse puts a glove on and sticks one or two fingers up you and actually tries to get her fingers inside your cervix. Your cervix is a sort of bony kind of opening, but it was like a sharp sort of pinching pain. I don't know about for you.
Yeah.
I mean, I think probably, I don't know whether, because you said it was triggering for you, I don't know whether there were sort of reasons for that that might have been historic that you were sort of, I don't know, that you didn't, that was more frightening for you. I have had a long history, unfortunately, of sort of gynecologists and various other people I fell on a diving board when I was 11 years old, so I have had quite a few people look up me, so I wasn't too worried about the kind of the thought of someone putting their fingers to sort of stimulate that cervix, but it was still pretty pinchy and painful, and you just have to grit your teeth and get through it. And so when you say you actually would have liked to have a chaperone, to have your husband there, that wasn't sort of talked about or discussed. It was just, you're coming off with us and we're just going to not explain what we're doing.
So firstly, I didn't know what to expect because, unlike you, I hadn't had gynecological examinations. So for me, it was basically pretty much the first time. I was really quite shocked by what was happening.
You'd never had someone sort of look up there?
Absolutely not. And I was really quite taken aback. And it's not like anyone explains to you what's going to happen. And obviously then when you're in the induction process, they're basically inserting pessaries into you every 6 hours to try and pump your body full of hormones. And obviously the next time round, I asked my husband to come and I was offered gas and air and I was holding his hands. But every time it was being done, my vagina was getting more and more painful. It was almost becoming bruised. And that's before I've even started contractions and gone into proper labour. I remember being, you know, on this suite for nearly 2 days before it got to the point where clearly my body was just refusing to go into labour. And they decided to pump me with oxytocin and to have a drip. And something I've written about in my book, which I've never talked about before, is that I have a huge phobia of having blood tests, of having needles. I mean, like, incredibly traumatising. I remember actually refusing some blood tests during pregnancy checkups because I get so frustrated and upset during the whole situation. And so for me, you know, being in labour, having already been there for 2 days and then having a drip in my hand and being hooked up to the machine and then being pumped full of hormones to force my body into contractions was extremely traumatizing. And that's before I've even got to the point where I'm, like, you know, pushing and my daughter's arriving and ending up in theater.
How was that? So I know that you have a phobia of injections and blood and everything else, because, you know, we did some of those together when we were much younger. I hate blood being drawn, and I definitely have to look the other way. And for me as well, that first labor, the cannula, the double cannula in my hand, was probably the most...
It makes me flinch.
Sorry, I shouldn't mention it. But it is. It's horrible. It's really horrible. And you're right. No one really explains it to you. And mine was wrongly cited and I had to ask for it to be recited. God. It was pretty grim. How was that dealt with? Because you presumably said to the nurses and the midwives there, by the way, I really struggle with this. Can you just, you know, you're going to have to talk me through it. You're going to have to help me out. Was there an adjustment made for that?
So that's why, back to your earlier point, it's so important that you do speak to the hospital. So because I knew that I had such a big phobia about it, I knew that they needed to have the senior anaesthetist and they had basically one shot to get it right. And I'd heard all these stories about people's hands being butchered and having to try multiple times to find the vein. And so to the hospital's credit, they did actually make sure that I met the anaesthetist in advance. She was the lady that came to see me on the day and she obviously did her best and she did bother to read my notes, and that made a huge difference, because to be honest, if that hadn't happened, I don't know how they'd have been able to get the IV in. And if I hadn't had that, I wouldn't have been able at a later date to have the epidural, because that's obviously how they could give me pain relief. And nobody prepares you for how absolutely excruciating contractions are. I mean, I think the best description I can give you is it was like a tube door just being repeatedly closed on my stomach, and it was just absolutely like punching like all the oxygen out of me, that I just couldn't breathe, doubled over in pain. And so of course, you know, the moment I was offered the chance of pain relief, I absolutely took it.
And one thing actually on that pain relief is that I don't know whether you knew this or you'd been prepared, but once the oxytocin goes in, those contractions go from what is a natural normal progression, which your body can roughly adjust to, even though it is excruciating, but your body can adjust to it, to something totally off the scale. So I was also given oxytocin however many hours into my labour, but I knew to say at the same time, cite the epidural and let's do the two at the same time, because I'd heard that that became basically unbearable, and that once you're in the throes of that, it's really hard to cite the epidural. So I'm surprised as well that no one had warned you that you could have the two at the same time and sort of avoid you all of this extra pain.
And actually making such an important point that because I didn't really know enough before I was in labour, you're basically just presented with a consent form and you're told to sign it, and you're so out of it because you're on drugs, you're in pain, you've been awake for hours and hours, you're completely sleep deprived, and you're basically signing a form that I can barely even remember what was on it. And I certainly didn't read it or have any expectation about kind of what I was signing my life away for. And I don't feel like I had informed consent at all. I just basically did what I was presented with at the time.
You've spoken about mental health advocates. What are they? And did you have recourse to one? What is that?
Yes, I was incredibly lucky. So because I had my phobia, I'd actually accessed specialist mental health services before my daughter was born. And that meant that they referred me to a specialist service, which was in Stafford, called Lotus. And they gave me access to what's called basically a mental health advocate. And I had this lovely lady called Judith, and she was a complete lifeline in hospital. Because firstly, when I was being induced, no one actually rang me. So every day I'd have my bag packed, ready to go into the hospital, and I'd ring the hospital and say, can I come in today? And no one would call me back. And it was only because I had a real person with a name and their telephone number that I could actually ring to Chase, and she got me booked in. But also then when I was in hospital, she was the only person I knew, Belle. So like, it's really frightening when you're like in this environment. I'm not someone who spent loads of time in hospital, and she was basically the only person I recognised, the only person who'd met me before. And she did bother to come and check on me.
Is that because Henry, your husband, was not there at the time?
No, so Henry was with me the whole time. But I meant having a medical staff professional whose job it was to just come and say hello, ask you how you are. And she was the only person that did try and explain to me what was going on. But I didn't know this at the time. But what I had was actually a specialist service. So if I'd been, you know, in a different NHS trust, or I hadn't had access because of my phobias, I actually wouldn't have had her there for me. So I could have gone into hospital and not known a single person that I saw during my entire labour. And obviously the shifts change every 8 hours. So you're basically having to like re-explain yourself, and there's a new person coming in who has no idea all the stuff that's happened to you before.
How did you get that mental, Judith, the mental health advocate? Did you have to ask and push for it, or was it presented to you and said, we think you would benefit from?
So that's why I was incredibly lucky. So I had no idea so much about this postcode lottery and maternity services, but because I had accessed specialist mental health before the birth, I was automatically referred. But as I said, if I'd been a mum who hadn't had the issue that I had with my needle and blood phobia, I wouldn't have been referred at all.
So this might be slightly relevant, because what you were saying about Judith having that one person who's there with you, and a lot of mums will, or expectant mums will, opt to have a doula or something along those lines. With my second child, I had spent, as a news anchor, I had spent the time that I was pregnant with my second child reporting persistently on maternity, you know, failing maternity services, stories about maternal deaths, excess child deaths, et cetera, et cetera. So obviously ideal as you're pregnant and looking forward to your birth. I took the decision to pay for a private midwife just for the birth period. So basically from 34 weeks to 42 weeks, who accompanied me through that period to do, I guess, essentially what Judith did for you, which is to have someone who's medical, who understands how this works, who's there for you and who can advocate for you when you know that you can't for yourself. And your husband, as great, he might be the best birth partner in the world, but your husband doesn't have the medical knowledge sometimes. Yeah. And so actually you
all know how the NHS system works, because all this terminology they're firing at you and you have no idea what they're talking about. And you make a really important point about dad. So I was incredibly lucky that my husband was with me throughout the whole 40-hour labour, and it was incredibly stressful for him. And there's basically no provision made for the dads at all. So I was obviously in the hospital bed, constantly attached to the CTG monitor, having had my baby's heartbeat monitored. And he was basically just told, here's one chair, you've got to sit in it for the next several days. And then he even got told off when he tried just to lie down on the floor with his own sleeping bag and pillow that he'd brought from home to try and, you know, get a few hours sleep so that he could support me as best that he could. And to be honest, if you didn't have someone with you, it would have been a nightmare, because he was the one going to get me a glass of water, going to get me food, get me snacks, because you're pretty much immobile. You're just like stuck in your bay during induction, you know, waiting for the baby to come. And, you know, I really wasn't checked on very often, Belle. I mean, there'd be hours and hours that would go past and we were just basically left on our own.
You see, this is interesting. And you have, you know, again, we will come to this a bit later, but you've gone global with now your campaign. It's my sense, when I've spoken to friends who've had babies in other countries, that that just doesn't happen. You don't get left for hours in labour on your own without a glass of water, without basic needs, without being able to go to the loo, et cetera, et cetera. Is your sense now, with everything you know, that the UK really just has got this very, very wrong?
So I actually don't think it's a problem just in the UK. So obviously, since I went public sharing my own story as a politician, I had a huge number of mums who sent in to me their stories. And it actually was very clear that there was just a lack of care for mums generally in lots of different countries around the world, not just in the UK. So I think there's so much more we could do, because obviously compassion is free. Things like the example you just gave of the glass of water. And I think people don't realise that those little tiny things are so important, like someone explaining to you what's going on, like someone saying, are you okay, coming in to check in on you. And I did find it really difficult having staff change every shift. And I only had the same midwife for that last bit of labour when I had the epidural. And I did have this lovely midwife who was with me during the pushing stage. And she was obviously holding my hand and was really supportive and was trying to get me through. But, you know, again, you only have her for a short period of time.
I feel like this is a good time for us to get into what will be the hardest bit, I think, for you to describe. You obviously have gone through all of this, the epidural up to now. And up to now, one could say, OK, well, yeah, it's a difficult birth, but that's sort of fairly routine and normal. Mm-hmm. It's not that unusual. Then after birth, you have your gorgeous baby. And then after birth, you start bleeding. And this is a postpartum hemorrhage. You are taken very quickly to surgery. And in your speech in Parliament, your very moving speech in Parliament, you talked about, you know, remembering the trolley bumping against the walls, etc. You say you thought you were going to die. And I wonder, with that, did anyone explain to you what was going on at that bit, like you were a human who could hear them?
God, this is so hard to talk about.
Take your time, because I know. So, you know, Theo, you are a very strong person, and I have known you for a very, very long time, and you are not someone who's prone to emotion. And I think, A, it's extraordinary that you've spoken about this publicly, also particularly in your professional environment. And I know it's hard for you to talk about even now, just with me. But take your time.
So, obviously, very long labour. I remember the final bit with pushing, and I was tired. I've never been so exhausted in my life. And I remember the midwife saying to me, I think she could tell I'd really run out of energy. And she just said, you know, the baby's going to get stuck if you don't do one final push. So I did one final push, and she came out, and I almost felt her like rip out of me. And I'll never forget that sensation of the head coming out and almost being like half stuck in, half stuck out of you. And she came out. And I had all these kind of expectations before that she's going to be put on my chest and she'd do the kind of the breastfeed crawl up to my breast and she'd start breastfeeding and it would all be this sort of magical golden hour that we'd spend together. And I remember holding her very briefly and she was all covered in blood and they took her away to wipe her and they tagged her foot. And then it was just basically complete pandemonium. I remember Henry, my husband, saying, you know, she's bleeding, is that normal? And obviously, I didn't really know what was going on because I was so out of it and so tired. And to be honest, I just wanted to sleep. I think that was the main thing I wanted to do. And I obviously must have lost a lot of blood. I think on my notes, it said 700 mil was that I lost straight after delivery. And I remember them changing all the sheets. It must have been that the sheets were all covered in blood. But I was quite delirious and pretty out of it. And I remember them taking Arabella away. And then they said to me, you know, you've got to go to emergency theatre. I don't think I really understood what was happening. I knew that I was having blood loss. I remember my daughter being taken away from me and it almost felt like I was being amputated. Like I felt like her separation of her being removed, having just had to arrive. And we were taken to the emergency theatre.
Was it Henry who was the one who noticed the blood loss?
So I definitely remember, I mean, it's quite hazy to be honest, because I was so out of it, but I definitely remember Henry saying she's bleeding is this normal? And then the thing I most remember actually was that the room has been quite quiet because it was basically just me and the midwife. And then suddenly all these people rushing in and there being like multiple members of NHS staff in the room. And I remember being put on the hospital trolley and being obviously taken to the theatre. And the thing I really remember is I was absolutely terrified and I kept my eyes really tightly closed so I couldn't see anything. But I could feel the trolley like bumping into the walls as they were taking around the corridors. And then honestly, the worst sensation in the world was when I was actually slid onto the operating table. And the only way I can describe it is it was basically like being a meat carcass, like in an abattoir is what I felt like. And then the thing that really scared me was that in my birth plan, we had obviously talked about if anything went wrong. And because of my phobias, I had said very, very strongly, I want to have a general anaesthetic if I had to have a cesarean, which is still quite unusual to have a C-section under a GA. I said, I don't want to be awake in surgery. That's my worst nightmare. And a C-section is quite a short operation. And they'd agreed that that would happen. And now I was suddenly being told, you can't have general anaesthetic. You've got to stay awake. And that for me was absolutely the worst news. Like the thought that I was going to have to lie awake with everyone talking about me in the operating theatre. So I actually refused to go on my own. And I was so insistent about having my husband there because, to be honest, I literally thought I was going to have a heart attack if I thought I had to be lying there in theatre awake for a really long time being stitched up while they tried to stop the blood loss. So the hospital did agree for my husband to come in. And if he hadn't been there holding my hand, talking to me the whole way through along with the surgeon, I mean, I think I would have had a complete breakdown because it was so traumatising to be there. And obviously, I was pretty out of it at the time, but I remember my husband and I have obviously discussed it afterwards, and it was really traumatizing for him too because he was sat obviously right next to me and he said he could just see these huge swabs of blood just being taken away, these huge cotton wool pads just covered in red, and he said there was one moment which I didn't see because obviously my eyes were closed, but he said that they basically looked at each other and it was not looking good, and he thought he was going to be a single dad. And what I find so interesting when I was talking to my therapist afterwards to kind of process what happened was that I have this huge mind blank bell for this 2 hour period. And I was awake completely for over 2 hours in surgery being stitched up. And I have kind of brief recollections of things like, for example, I remember that there was a more junior doctor who was originally doing my stitches for the tear. And then they got halfway through and it must have been really bad because they actually asked a senior surgeon to scrub up and to step into the operation and to complete the stitches at the back. So I had what was called a third degree tear where there's basically a rip between the vagina and the anus. And they were very lucky they were able to stitch 50% of it back together, which means I can still go to the toilet. Whereas if they hadn't been able to do that and I had a fourth degree tear, I would have been incontinent for the rest of my life. And bearing in mind, I knew nothing about this. I was just lying there in the operating table and I knew something was wrong and it was very serious. And then I think what was really distressing me as well was that I'd been separated from Arabella. So, you know, you spend 9 months waiting for your daughter to arrive. And then I actually spent several hours not with her at all. And no one told me where she was. They didn't update me. I didn't see her. No one took the time to say who she's being looked after by. And I think that also caused me a lot of psychological distress being separated from her, whilst I also thought I was going to die and never see her again.
Theo, I'm so sorry that you went through all of that. And thank you for sharing it with us. I know it's not easy for you to talk about. That moment that you talked about when Arabella was taken away from you right at the beginning, if we begin with that, you've talked about it almost that wrench, that pull, and obviously very quickly other feelings sort of cascaded on top of that. Is it your sense that that separation could have been avoided if, you know, if maybe there had been a way of keeping her a little bit longer with you or something like that?
So difficult to know. I mean, I'm not a medical professional and I totally understand in theatre. They obviously don't want to have a baby there. I think what I found really difficult was also when I came out. So I was obviously in the recovery wards, having had major surgery, and I didn't see my daughter then either. And I think what really stressed me out was basically not knowing where she was or how she was. And to be honest, I thought something had happened to her. I remember having this like deep, deep sense of grief of like, had my baby died? And that's why they hadn't come in to tell me where she was or how she was. And actually, I later found out she'd apparently been with the midwives in their tea break and they'd all been having a nice time with her, passing her around, having a cup of tea. but no one actually took the time to come and tell me or my husband where she was. And it wasn't until later that I was moved to a different room. You know, this is several hours later that she was then brought to me in one of those incubator cots and sat next to me. And I was so broken. I couldn't sit up. I remember I had a catheter. I had a hook up to drip, and remember my fears about the epidural because they were worried I had an infection because my temperature had hugely spiked during surgery. And the thing that really shocked me was that I have never been so vulnerable and so traumatized in my whole life. And I remember pressing the emergency button for help because she was screaming in the cot next to me. I think Henry had gone to get a sandwich or a cup of tea. And this lady came in and she just said, "Not my baby, not my problem." And just walked out and left me there.
When I needed help after my birth trauma, Erwin Mitchell's team of experts provided the support I needed to rebuild my life.
At Erwin Mitchell, we work closely with our clients through any challenges. We understand the impact of a birth injury and can help get the best medical support and rehabilitation for our clients and their families. Authorised and regulated by the Solicitors Regulation Authority.
And I couldn't even pick my daughter up, let alone feed her, change her nappy, do anything. And I was basically paralysed from the waist down from the epidural. And, you know, that was the moment that I needed the most compassion and I was just abandoned.
Who was that lady?
So it was a lady in the hospital, and I'm afraid I did actually have to make a formal complaint to the hospital.
But a midwife?
One of the team working on the ward that night. And it was a busy weekend in August. I mean, they were obviously massively understaffed, hugely understretched in the ward. But back to my point earlier about compassion being free, like, even if you're busy, and I appreciate midwives do a really difficult job, but, you know, show some compassion for someone who's just been through my experience. Mm. And, you know, that was like about the worst thing I could be told when I was feeling at my absolute lowest. And it made me feel like such a failure as a mum, because I'd assumed that I would be fine post-birth. You know, I'd done all my prep. I thought I'd be looking after my daughter. We'd be breastfeeding. And what actually happened was I was so incapacitated. I had to be carried to the loo. I had to have a bedpan. I was bleeding heavily in the shower. I was, you know, excuse my French, basically defecating across the floor in the hospital. Mm. And I wouldn't even get to the loo in time because I just couldn't control my bowels. You know, all I could think about was looking after me. And I had absolutely no way that I could look after my daughter. And obviously my husband was exhausted. I mean, Henry had been awake for basically 3 days. And I remember he had to call my mum and just say, you need to come now. I just can't do it anymore. You've got to help. And the fact that no one even, like, you know, helped to change my daughter's nappy when my husband was exhausted. He'd been up for, you know, 3 nights. And my mum had to come and basically do it because the staff in the hospital just wouldn't help.
There's so much to unpack in all of that, and I know you've spent the last couple of years unpacking bits of that. Let's start, because, you know, we're focusing here on the personal. Let's start with your psychological state, and you talk about that blanked out 2 hour period where you were in surgery, and the fact that you know, bits of it sort of come back to you. I know you've gone through a lot of therapy. It's funny, when you spoke about the junior surgeon being replaced by the more senior surgeon, weirdly I had a memory of you saying that. But I think I remember you saying that from a conversation quite soon after the birth, where you said it in an almost jokey fashion and slight, like it was lighthearted, and that you were a little bit cross, but that was it. And I think this is it. We just had no idea, your close friends, that beneath what sounded like a war wound and, you know, a badge of honour of a story of a crazy birth was actually a deep post-traumatic stress situation as well. That 2 hour blanked out period, what do you now understand about what your brain was doing, the fact that it just blanked out those 2 hours?
So to be honest, I didn't really know that mums could get PTSD. I actually have always associated it with like a war context, you know, of a veteran being out in the field and somewhere like Iraq or Afghanistan. And obviously now I've done a lot more reading about birth trauma and basically realised that what happened to me is an emergency situation like that, and your body is just triggered into shutdown because it's so overwhelming, it just can't cope. I think I thought I was fine. So I think on the physical side, I knew something was wrong because I was majorly struggling with the toilet. So quite often I wouldn't make it even from my bedroom to the bathroom, which is a couple of metres away. I remember the first 2 weeks.
Are we talking there about bladder, or are we talking about bowel?
No, both. Mm. Both bladder and bowel. And I remember,
were you wearing a nappy at this point?
Yes, so I had to basically wear an adult nappy at the beginning, and I was very heavily bleeding as well for multiple weeks afterwards. And I also couldn't sit down. So the first, I think about a week I was at home, I actually didn't leave the bedroom. So every single meal my husband had to bring to me on a tray. I just about crawled to the bathroom, sometimes on time, sometimes didn't make it. Had to basically wear, you know, adult nappies because the, you know, incontinence was so bad and the heavy bleeding.
I want to be, you know, we are breaking taboos, we're being graphic here. If you have an open wound, which is trying to heal on your vaginal area, like all that rectal vaginal area, and you then, as you say, do a poo in what is a nappy, you don't make it, that's then rubbing all over that area, which needs to stay clean. So what happened? I mean, for me, I would feel as though you'd still be in hospital. You'd be in you'd be being cleaned by a nurse multiple times a day. Mm. That makes sense to me. How can you be at home and how can you be making sure that you're not getting an infection?
So that's when basically I ended up just going on Google to see what to do. So one of the piece of advice I think I saw from Mumsnet was to basically have a jug of water and to literally like wash yourself every time you went to the loo. And to be honest, it was a really frightening time because firstly, I didn't understand what my birth injury was. So I was like, is this normal? Is this something that just happens to everybody? Because I knew most people told me that, you know, basically have your period for like, you know, 5 or 6 weeks post birth. But this was not that. This was like actually having major problems going to the toilet. And I remember being given laxatives and they said to me, drink lots of water. And I do remember being told that, but I don't remember being told why. So no one really made it clear to me. And I was incredibly
and we
lucky.
And we should say that the reason for that is that if you were to get constipated and have a very hard stool, that poo could potentially break what has been reconstructed between your rectum and your vagina.
And then
vagina.
I would have had a situation for the rest of my life where I would have been permanently incontinent.
Yeah.
So no one really explained that. And also I now know more things about things like prolapse and stuff. If I'd been straining on the toilet, I could have ended up with, you know, other organs coming into your vagina, which you then have again for the rest of your life. So no one really took the time to explain that. And I was incredibly lucky that my husband was basically able to look after our daughter completely because I was in zero state to do anything at all. And the birth injury, I really only discovered from reading about the leaflet and then researching online.
What's this leaflet? Is that the one that you found?
That was the one that I originally found in the box.
So you had collected these leaflets that people had given to you in hospital.
Exactly. But I obviously hadn't read them when I was in hospital because I was in no fit state to be sitting down to read, you know, here's an A4 leaflet and it was just put in your hospital bag. And then I think the PTSD was much later. So I thought I was fine and I didn't have any mental health symptoms. And the first time I realised that there was a problem was sort of two things. First is my husband said I became incredibly OCD. So I'm normally actually quite messy. I will leave piles of books and magazines around the house.
I can confirm, having lived with you a number of years, that you...
And I became obsessively OCD. I would see crumbs behind the toaster and I'd be like, I'd be going to full detox of like, I need to clean the whole kitchen when Arabella's having her sleep and I wouldn't rest. I'd like excessively clean the house and be like getting out the Dettol and washing all the time. And then the second time I noticed it, looking back now, is I remember going to the pub near Stafford to meet the mums in my NCT group. And the journey was about 5 miles. I actually stopped the car with my daughter in the car seat 3 times and pulled over in lay-bys because I was convinced that she died and actually got out to check that she was breathing and then was then driving another mile. And then I stopped the car again, have a basically complete panic anxiety attack.
Were you driving at this point?
And I was driving on my own with her. First time I went to basically see anybody. And I didn't realise that that was strange behaviour. And now I know that is this extreme hypervigilance. And I think it's because I've been separated from my daughter, you know, when she'd arrived, that I basically almost thought that if I couldn't see her, something had happened to her. And I was just convinced that she'd stopped breathing. And she was absolutely fine. We were just driving, you know, 5-10 minutes to get to the local pub. And it's only now when I look back at those early days that I realised something was really wrong. And then I got referred to a mental health specialist who then, you know, gave me therapy for nearly a whole year after the birth to try and process those memories.
How did you get referred? Did you recognise this with you and between you and Henry and then go, okay, we need to go and see someone? Or did someone within the medical circuit pick up on it?
So I think, to be honest, it was probably my husband who obviously really noticed a difference in my behaviour. So he was very keen on me having access to mental health specialist support. I'll be honest, I was quite sceptical, actually. So he'd recommended to me that I tried this eye processing memory technique where they get you to kind of recall traumatic memories. I was not that keen. I was like, this is completely pointless. You know, why am I going to dig up these awful memories of being in surgery or having the cannula inserted? And I wasn't keen to do it. But he was like, give it a go. And to be honest, I actually had a bit of a breakdown the first time that it worked. So you basically have to follow this kind of dot moving on a screen. And I was doing it all remotely because we'd obviously come out of COVID. And I remember having to be asked to process these traumatic memories. And I'm quite a straightforward, upbeat, clearly kind of person. And I was in the middle of this call with this therapist lady. And I remember just having this complete breakdown and being absolutely hysterically sobbing, sat at my computer. And suddenly all these memories came out, which had just been bottled up, and it really worked. And an example I can give you, I remember with the cannula, like before, the memory always used to be of them inserting it, you know, trying to find the vein in my hand, which I find incredibly squeamish and makes me very faint. But now I can actually see the after image where my husband very cleverly wrapped my hand actually in a sort of turquoise pashmina. So I couldn't see my hand and see the thing in my vein. And that's now the image that I have. So it's like the brain has processed and almost put the memory away, and now it's moved forward in time. And now when I think back to that, I think back to later in time, and it has partly processed the memory. So having been incredibly skeptical, I've actually found it's really helped. And obviously I've been processing my own story, but also running the birth trauma inquiry in Parliament. You know, I had over 1300 mums write into me with their stories, and I didn't feel remotely equipped emotionally to be listening to these incredibly tragic stories of baby loss or mums with severe injuries. And I found that very difficult to read their stories.
Where were you on your own therapy journey when you started reading these stories? Were you by this point already, had you processed quite a lot of it, or were you coming to these stories from other mums completely untherapized, as it were?
Yeah, so thank goodness I had started already, because I didn't actually launch the birth trauma inquiry for, you know, over a year after my daughter had arrived. So I had done quite a bit of mental health work, but to be honest, I didn't prioritise it enough, because being an MP is obviously an extremely unusual job in the UK, and we don't have maternity leave like, you know, the rest of the public. So even when I'd just come out of hospital and I'd had this incredibly difficult, traumatic experience, I was still having to work. And I remember being really upset when, you know, some constituents actually rang my office within a week of my daughter arriving and complaining and saying, why can't we see our MP face to face? We demand to have a constituency surgery. You know, she's been out of hospital, quote, a whole week. Why can't we see her in person? And they didn't know that I was in a nappy, stuck upstairs, you know, bleeding, couldn't pick my daughter up, and was really not in a fit state. And it took me an incredibly long time to tell anyone. I think the first person I actually told properly what had happened to me was when Kim from the Birth Trauma Association, their chief exec, came in to see me in Parliament. And I sent her this random email out of the blue because I wanted to learn a bit more about the topic and if other mums had suffered as well. And I found it really quite therapeutic talking to her, someone I didn't know, to be honest, who really just sat and listened to my story. And then she offered for some other mums to come into the House of Commons to meet with me. And that was kind of a life-changing moment, because I had never met other mums who'd been through what I had. So yes, I had friends like you who'd had children, and I had my NCT friends who were local mums, but I hadn't met anyone else who'd been through what I had and who kind of had suffered from a birth injury or had suffered from major mental health issues. And these 10 mums came in to see me for a cup of tea. And I think we were meant to have a meeting for an hour, and it massively overran. We were there for 2 hours, and they all just went round and shared their story. And bearing in mind, we're at work, and I actually ended up bursting into tears halfway through the meeting, which was completely unlike me. I mean, I've never done that before in a professional context, but it was actually so reassuring to know that you're not alone. And that's partly why I set this podcast up, because I literally did not know anybody else where this has happened to them, and I didn't know what to say or who to ask for help. And I met those other mums through the Birth Trauma Association, and they'd had very similar experiences, and they'd had exactly the same questions, and we did find help, but so many of our friends just don't know where to ask.
Well, and I think you touch on a really important part there, which is there is a sense that the line between what mums just have to expect and sort of deal with and what is actually not okay is very blurred. It's very hard to work out, you know, is walking around as I do with a prolapse after birth, is that just normal? I personally have just come to believe that that's what happens in the UK. I know I'm a bit half French, and I know that if I were in France, it would not be normal. So I'm able to take steps to rectify it as much as I can. But I think there is something in the UK, and I wonder if it's also culturally around midwifery and sort of natural births, and I know that this is being addressed in the NHS maternity policies at the moment, we have had such an emphasis on natural birth that there seems almost to be a kind of gatekeeping of pain, and it becomes a badge of honour. Mm. And almost like people share their war stories, they share their birth stories. I mean, surely that is part of your campaign that has to end.
Well, absolutely. I mean, the amount of mums who've written to me to share their stories since I talked about my own experience and have said they were told things like, you know, to breathe through the pain or stop being so dramatic. And actually they'd suffered, you know, fourth degree tear and went on to lose their job or suffer incontinence the rest of their life or end up having to have major surgery.
Theo, imagine if, just for a second, if a man
yeah,
had a surgical procedure or some kind of life-changing procedure.
Yeah, we'd be spending a lot more money and talking about it a lot
more. Or broke a leg or broke a limb or whatever else and was told to breathe through the pain. We're not going to give you anaesthetic. Yeah. We're going to perform this sort of surgery.
And you know what I also think it is, Belle? It's that you're basically told we've got a healthy baby, so you should be grateful. And I think that the entire narrative's either about the pregnant mum or it's about the baby. And no one actually asks us about the mum and the fact that we're the second patient in the room. So that's basically what led me to set up this new cross-CAR-T campaign. So I remember going to research in the House of Commons Library about upcoming debates. And I just assumed that birth trauma was a topic that we discussed and I would go and speak in somebody else's debate. And then I discovered that there actually wasn't one. There'd actually never been in 1,000 years of the British Parliament a single debate on birth trauma. I was absolutely shocked. So that's why I went and gave the speech where I talked about my own experience. And I was really touched that actually quite a few mums came to watch my speech in the chamber. And I remember them standing up at the top watching. And gosh, I felt the pressure because they'd obviously written to me and shared their stories and they really wanted to have change and they wanted the NHS to improve and have the Prime Minister to do something. And I hope that by me, you know, sharing my story publicly in Parliament, it did start a national conversation to say that there are issues and we need to talk about it.
That was quite a moment when you shared your story in Parliament because you did cry, you did show emotion, which, as we've discussed, is not something you're kind of prone to do normally in a professional context. I wonder, having Henry, because I believe he was there also to listen, having Henry there, having those mums there, but also having, in essence, your colleagues, some of whom, in the way that the House of Commons is set up, are quite adversarial towards you normally, having all of that collide in one moment, what did that feel like?
Well, it was really the most extraordinary moment because I'd obviously planned my speech and I'd put in all the stories of the mums and the statistics I wanted to share. But I had not thought about the fact that it's incredibly emotional to stand up in the Chamber of Parliament with all that history, knowing you're live on television being watched. And I completely unexpectedly burst into tears. And I actually couldn't get through my speech. And I was incredibly grateful that my colleague, Dame Andrea Ledgson, she basically saw that I was not in a good way. And she stood up and she interrupted me and basically gave me time to kind of, you know, sort of collect my thoughts and finish my speech. And I was really embarrassed, actually, because I thought, oh, my God, this is my place of work. You know, constituents are watching. This is, you know, really unprofessional to burst into tears at work. And I think it just shows how incredibly traumatized I still was that, you know, every time I started to talk about it, I was just unable to process it. And I just basically broke down in floods of tears.
Yeah. And I mean, look, this is why I love you, certainly, Theo, which is that for a lot of people, that would have been okay. Well, that was horrible. I'm leaving that behind me. For you, that was a catalyst for saying, ah, no, something has to change here. That was not a failure, what just happened there. That was actually a strength because it shows how powerful this moment is. That moment obviously resonated with thousands of women around the country because you got the results of it and you had people talking about it for days afterwards. And that spurred you on to setting up your inquiry, the all-party parliamentary group that you did. So the Birth Trauma Inquiry, which reported in May of 2024, that was the cross-party investigation you did into failings in maternity care. You heard from 1,400 people, roughly. Some of the key recommendations of that, ending the postcode lottery that we've talked about, adding birth trauma to women's health strategy, the women's health strategy, appointing a maternity commissioner, which is one of your big ones at the moment, recruiting more midwives, improving those midwives' training, making perinatal mental health support more available, rolling out the obstetric anal sphincter injury care bundle, which I'd never heard of before, to all hospitals in hospital trusts in England, which has already been proven to reduce the risk of injuries. And one of your big ones as well, having one maternity policy rather than lots of different maternity policies written around all over the place. Where we are now, and you know, you've got this now, thankfully, 2 years, more than 2 years sort of in the rearview mirror of the birth trauma that you suffered. How confident do you feel now that the government has taken on board your report, your findings, and is working on them, is thinking about them?
Yeah. So firstly, if you told me, you know, 5 years ago when I first got elected that I'd be, you know, best known in Parliament for running a maternity campaign, I would have thought you were completely crazy, because I actually felt completely not an expert at all in health policy. But I basically kind of learned on the job through running this campaign. And the first thing I say is, I think the reason why the inquiry was successful in advocating for change was because it was cross-party. And you mentioned that the House of Commons is so adversarial. I mean, even the way we're set up as a building, you know, we don't sit in a circle. We sit opposite each other in a sort of gladiatorial arena, sort of, you know, fighting against each other. And a massive credit to the then Labour MP Rosie Duffield, who came on board as the co-chair of the inquiry with me, and a huge number of MPs from lots of different political parties who saw that there was a problem and we needed to do something about it. But obviously our sort of headline recommendations were accepted by the previous government. And I suppose my concern going forward is that, you know, we now have a new government, and actually it's up to, you know, successive governments to implement the reforms that we recommended in our report. And, you know, we did have a kind of roadmap. We had more than 40 specific policy recommendations, some of them quite small things like, you know, the GP appointment. I mentioned about obviously the appointment being mainly about my daughter, not me. So one of the small changes was a really big one for mums, though, is to make sure that your GP 6-week checkup actually asks about your mental and physical health, not just your babies.
Yeah, because of course, if you don't, if the mum is not able to look after herself, she certainly isn't able to look after a new baby.
Well, exactly. So I'm very hopeful that the new government will obviously keep all the recommendations that the previous government had committed to. But I keep asking for this national maternity strategy, because I was shocked that there wasn't standardised maternity care in the UK. I only learnt that through my own personal experience and running the birth trauma inquiry. And all the evidence showed that there is basically a postcode lottery in maternity care. So you mentioned right at the beginning me getting access to specialist services. But, you know, if I'd lived 20 miles down the road, I wouldn't have had access to those services. But because I was a politician, I was obviously in a position to do something about it. So I hope that the birth trauma inquiry has kind of started a conversation, has got government to take action. And I really hope that the new government completely implements in full all of our recommendations.
You've now gone global with your Birth Trauma Alliance. I wonder, A, how you feel the UK rates amongst other like for like countries, as it were, OECD countries perhaps, and also what can be done on a more global scale to tackle this? Or is it just country by country?
So I think that's what really struck me, was that when I was doing the birth trauma inquiry, mums in the UK were writing to me. But I've now started receiving stories from mums around the world. And if you read my book, Breaking the Taboo, I've actually included a whole section at the back of new stories. So these are mums that didn't write into the inquiry. They didn't even know about it. They heard about it subsequently. And that includes places, you know, war zones, conflict areas, where, can you imagine, their access to services is so bad. So I hope that kind of the birth trauma inquiry is the kind of linchpin of a much bigger campaign of how do you globally improve maternity care. And I think we don't have a frank enough discussion about risks in childbirth. And, you know, I've been to visit maternity units in Sierra Leone and Kenya and some really rural services in Africa, where, you know, mothers were walking through several days from their village to try and access healthcare. You know, and I met one mother who told me, you know, she walked for, I think it was 3 days to get to the hospital, and then arrived and been told her daughter had died. And then she had to obviously have the fetus removed, and she had no help, no support, then just stigma when she goes back to her village. So I really feel very strongly that, you know, this campaign has got to be so much bigger. We need to have a Me Too movement for birth, because, you know, my experience in the UK, other mums' experiences here in this country, I'm afraid being echoed around the globe. And if you live in a less developed country with less access to services, your experiences are going to be even worse because you don't have the specialist services that we have.
And across the board, but I say, yeah, but perhaps particularly in certain communities, the squeamishness around women's bodies and bodily functions, well, it just needs to end, because there is no way of helping women if we're not going to be prepared to talk about their parts, you know, without, you know, let's talk about vulvas, let's talk about vaginas, let's not use cute little, you know, nicknames for them, because it does need to be talked about. I have a friend who worked actually in Sierra Leone in a fistula clinic, and a fistula is basically what you would have ended up with
exactly
if you had been giving birth in Africa, which is a complete rupture between your vagina and your rectum, and you would have been pooing and peeing out of the same hole, and you would have been in this particular community where he was working, you would have been ostracized, you would have been essentially, excluded from the community, and you would have been left to fend for yourself. I mean, it is absolutely brutal the way that women are being treated. Mothers, pregnant women are being treated in all of this maternity care. So it's amazing that you're doing it. You mentioned the book. It's a memoir. Gosh, it's very unlike me to plug books, but this is your podcast, so I think I'll allow you plugging a book. I'll help you plug the book.
And I'm also raising money for the Birth Trauma Association, because they are such an amazing charity.
Well, that's fantastic. Right. So it's a memoir. It does blend the personal and the political. And I think that's something we definitely should say here, is that we've focused a lot on the personal, but your book also deals with everything you were going through at the same time as this, you know, having to try and proxy vote whilst as you were, you know, almost on your deathbed it is an extraordinary state of affairs. And perhaps Parliament needs to also have a good look at itself in terms of how it runs its affairs and how it can make itself more inclusive to women and women giving birth. Before we leave you and me, there are a couple of questions that you often like your guests, and I wonder whether you like to ask your guests, and I wonder whether you have answers to those same questions. So one of them is about a specific piece of advice, perhaps just one specific piece of advice that you would give to women or families listening.
So I think the first is actually ask for help. I mean, I'm really shocked to hear what you said about things like the prolapse. You just think that's normal. Like the amount of mums who've just basically had terrible symptoms for like 10, 20, 30 years, and they just have been living with it. So I think my first point is like, it's never too late to ask. So it doesn't matter if your birth was 3 months ago or 30 years ago. Like if you need help and you think something is wrong, you need to ask for help. And there's a couple of specific resources, like the Birth Trauma Association website is fantastic. They're really good on the mental health. There's some really good charities out there like MASIC, which help mums with birth injuries. So there's some really good voluntary groups out there. And they can also connect you to a peer group of other mums who've suffered the same as you. So to know that you're not alone and that you can talk to someone with the same symptoms is really helpful.
Okay, that's great. And then the other question you often ask is, if you could ask the Prime Minister to change just one thing about maternity care, what would it be?
Well, firstly, implement my birth trauma recommendations in the inquiry.
There's about 40 of those.
Yeah, there's about 40 of those. But I think the headline point would be just ending the postcode lottery. I do find it really shocking that depending on where you give birth in the UK, you will be offered a different level of services. So the specialist care that I was offered is not available in certain constituencies. So that would be my number one. And also, as a former politician, you made the point about modernising Parliament. I don't believe that Parliament is a fit 21st century workplace. And it is so ironic, and I've talked about this in one of my chapters, about how crazy it is that we are the Parliament that's setting the laws that companies follow on maternity leave, and we don't follow our own policies. So we're completely hypocritical. And we know that there's a problem with female representation in Parliament. We want to make Parliament more representative of democracy. And I'm afraid, let's say it, you need to have women of childbearing age to stand as politicians. And that means you've got to make it more family friendly. We've got to look at late night hours, and we've got to make it a more modernised workplace for the 21st century.
Hear, hear. Just finally on you, where are you at now? We are, as I said, more than 2 years down the line from your birth trauma. Where are you on your road to recovery, both physically and also psychologically?
So I think physically I've accepted now that I'm never going to go back 100% to what I was like before. And I think if anyone had told me that, you know, your body would be fundamentally changed by childbirth, I really didn't understand the ramifications of that. So I think for me, it's more about managing and learning to live with symptoms.
Are you in pain?
No, not in pain anymore. It's more just issues with going to the loo. I'll have the rest of my life, but you know, I'm learning to cope.
What are those kind of issues?
Oh, just little things like, you know, for example, this morning I was trying to brush my daughter's teeth, and I find it really difficult to control wind because I just obviously don't have the same pelvic floor. And my daughter sort of burst out laughing and was like, "Mummy, poo poo." But actually, you know, that is something I'm going to have to live with for the rest of my life, that I just can't control basically my bowel movements in the same way that I did before.
Do you still have to wear something in your pants?
No, I don't anymore, but it's taken me a long time to get to that point where I'm not worrying about it. And I do worry doing certain sports and things like riding a bicycle or jumping and, you know, things that were quite basic actually, but I now have to kind of actively think, is that something I want to do? And
do mums go on trampolines?
Probably not. I don't think I'll be doing that anytime soon. And I think what I've learned is to talk about it. I mean, like, I could not have had this conversation with you about 2 years ago. I mean, firstly, I didn't understand what had happened to me. And secondly, I didn't feel remotely comfortable about talking about it. But I do think that having now shared my story multiple times, having met other mums, having, you know, run this inquiry in Parliament to hear about stories in maternity care across the UK, firstly made me feel less alone. And that's partly why I wanted to write my book and to do the podcast, is to make a community, really, for other mums who are listening. You know, and you might be driving to work right now listening to me and Belle and thinking, actually, I've got similar symptoms to Theo and I didn't realise I had birth trauma. So I hope that, you know, we can give them help and resources. And I'll make sure in the show notes there's loads of links to useful things that mums can find, or families listening who want to help a friend or a mum who needs support.
And I noticed you dodged the psychological question. Where are you on that?
I think that's more of a work in progress. I still find hospitals incredibly triggering. Like, you know, I think the other day I got a letter asking me for like a cervical smear test and I just put it in the bin. Like, the thought of having a vaginal examination and going into hospital, even though of course I should be having a cervical cancer checkup, I just really can't go there yet. So I know that there's a lot more support that I need with that, and it's a work in progress.
Are you getting that support? Because I know your 12 months of NHS mental health support have finished. What happens now?
Well, I mean, the brutal answer is you have to pay for it yourself. So the NHS support is only there for a set period of time. And, you know, I had my daughter now over 2 years ago, so I'm no longer eligible for the NHS specialist care that I had. So, you know, I will have to look at, you know, getting some form of private health with that. And the fact that I don't want to go to that appointment, right, is so telling. Mm. And is that I do need to have help and extra support. And I think, you know, writing the book, I found very traumatic, because I was obviously reliving all of these moments in my life which were really difficult. And as you said, Belle, I didn't really talk to friends or my mum or my family, and actually I've almost found it easier writing it down. But it's also brought up so much stuff, because I'm reliving, you know, being in theatre, I'm reliving separation from my daughter. So I think there's a whole probably second piece of work that I'll need to do once the book's out and the podcast has been launched, to try and bury and process those memories properly. In a way that I maybe haven't done yet.
Yeah, and perhaps that community building that you're doing now, finding this community of mums who have been through similar things, might go some way to helping heal as well for you psychologically. As you said, often it's been the people who've gone through it that you've found the most easy to talk to.
Definitely. And I know from talking to people who've had cancer, they've said the same to me, that it's very difficult for someone who's not had the same experience as you to relate to what you did. But I find talking to other mums who've suffered from birth trauma has been hugely helpful. And also hearing the really positive stories. Like, one of the mums I had on earlier in the series was Jill Castle, who's a mum I met through the BTA. And, you know, she lost her job and now she's gone into amazing things, like, you know, swim the channel and be, you know, a real champion for living with a stoma bag. And I wouldn't have met someone like Jill if I hadn't started this campaign. So that gives me a lot of, like, positivity that, you know, even if we can't physically 100% recover, that doesn't mean we can't lead a fulfilling, healthy, you know, normal life as possible. And hearing from mums like her is really inspiring for me too on my own road to recovery.
Mm, I think you're right. I think a little bit of honesty about the fact that the female body will go through, when it has a child, the most insane, life-changing event, whatever happens. And that the idea that we can bounce back to exactly what we were before is a little bit fanciful, but that that doesn't have to be negative. We can still find, you know, happiness and joy and, you know, enjoyment of our bodies on the other side. I think that's really, really important. Theo, thank you for sharing your story. I know it's not been easy at times. It's really important. It's really important to all the mums who are listening, to the expectant mums as well, who shouldn't be scared, but should just find out more, because knowledge is power. So I think, you know, thank you for being so honest, for being so open, and for taking this, talking about vaginas in the House of Commons. I mean, that's quite that's quite something. And I know that in this episode we've focused a lot on the personal. Your book will go much more into the political. We could have gone down another avenue today and in this episode spoken a lot more about the political. I am hoping that once your book is out and some of the juicy bits of gossip that I'm sure are in there about working as an MP under, what, 3 prime ministers in under 5 years and all the craziness of that and everything else you went through. Once that's out, I hope we can have another episode where we can talk a little bit about the politics as well.
Brilliant. Well, thank you so much, Belle, for coming in. And actually, it's really nice to chat about this stuff. And I think it's really important.
Who would have known, you know, whatever it was, how many years ago, decades ago now, that we would have been doing this? You know, we've gone from periods to sort of epinos and fistulas and all the rest of it. What a thing to be a woman. Well, look, Theo, thank you very much, and good luck with the rest of the campaign.
Thank you so much.